The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Thanks, everybody. Leah and I are going to do a little tag team here. So I'm going to give a little introduction, and then she's going to speak, and then kick it back to me, just so folks don't get a little confused. All right? So over the... 2018 began with over a year into just a reign of terror, of psychological warfare and Gestapo tactics against immigrant communities in this country, and it really didn't seem like things could get worse, and then they did. The stories of over 2,000 children, some as young as 9 months old, being ripped from their parents. Babies, toddlers, children, literally warehoused in horrifying conditions, sent in front of immigration judges without lawyers, or sent across the country away from their parents without so much as a tracking number, have shocked and horrified people across the country and galvanized truly just a tsunami of outrage. You saw activists, celebrities, politicians descend on the detainment camps in Texas. We've seen Microsoft workers and Amazon workers demanding that their companies cut ties with DHS, airline workers pressuring airlines to come out against transporting children away from their parents, people gathering at airports, marches and occupations at detention centers around the country, and there were an astounding 700 protests in 750 cities this last Saturday that I'm sure many people in this room participated in. And it was such a huge movement that Trump literally practically overnight had to reverse course and say that he was going to stop this policy that he had said was, overnight he had to reverse this policy, although as we know, his solution is not much, to detain families together is not much better. And there's all sorts of legal precedent behind that. He's since been forced by a federal judge to reunite these families, and it's sent federal agencies scrambling to do so, because it turns out that Customs and Border Patrol deleted the files of which parents go with which children, because they thought it would be better to track them separately since they were being separated. However, while people have been galvanized by the barbarity and open racism of this specific Trump policy, one of the interesting things about this moment is that it has shone a light spotlight for a much wider layer of people on the brutal reality of our immigration system that long predates Trump. In many ways, Trump's policies are a continuation and escalation of a deportation machine and brutal security state that has been built up over decades. And it doesn't take much to peel back the layers to see it. Like when pictures circulated around Facebook of children in cages, and guess what? It turned out those pictures were from during the Obama administration. The ACLU, during all of this stuff around family separation, the ACLU issued a report about child detention under the Obama administration that is stomach-turning. I forced myself to read it, and it was traumatizing just reading the report itself. Everything you see in the pictures of children being held in completely, inappropriate conditions, but all the way up to physical violence, sexual violence, tasering, and kids being put in stress positions. And the Obama administration does not have plausible deniability about this, because all the reports that the ACLU went over came from DHS's own oversight committees. So they knew absolutely everything about this. The sudden emergence of the demand to abolish ICE being taken up not just by socialists like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, but by mainstream Democrats like Kirsten Gillibrand, is also a reflection of this. the recognition that the brutality goes far beyond the family separation issue at the border, but to the everyday functioning of an agency that has been keeping millions of people living in fear and is tearing families apart across the country every day. While people obviously mean very different things when they say abolish ICE, the slogan itself is nonetheless a recognition that it is not just about Trump and Trump's policies, but something inherent to the very nature of an agency that has been built up through both Democratic and Republican administrations for decades. So this presentation is going to be partially about the continuity between the immigration control regime before Trump and under Trump. But it's also going to be about what's different and frighteningly dangerous under the Trump administration. Because while there's continuity, there's also a way in which Trump's policies are also a radical break from the prior status quo. Of course, the US government has a long history of openly discriminating against certain racial and ethnic groups to control immigrants and immigration. But in the post-civil rights era, after mass movements demanded an end to racial discrimination and set a new standard for public discourse, the government had to find a way to find seemingly race-neutral ways to control immigrants. Just as Michelle Alexander talks about in her book, The New Jim Crow, about the mass incarceration system, race-neutral language about crime has been used to control black populations and keep them into so many people into secondhand citizen status has also been used around immigration. The new immigration regime that has built up over the last several decades it has covered up its racial implications with the good immigrant, bad immigrant framework that has been used for decades to keep the supposedly good, law-abiding immigrants waiting for some sort of relief while bad immigrants are quote-unquote bad immigrants are cracked down upon. Trump has dispensed with the race-neutral language and declared war on all immigrants, targeting Muslims and Mexicans and other Central Americans in particular. In doing so, he is throwing red meat at his nativist and right-wing populist base, who were key to his election and potential re-election. In this process, he's given a national platform to the idea that immigrants are a threat to quote-unquote American workers, physically, economically, and socially. However, at the same time, he's undermining the legitimacy of the whole immigration system in the eyes of millions of people, and is forcing a debate on our side about what kind of reform we need to fight for, and whether we can accept compromises that have just proved to further criminalize people who are just trying to survive. So at this point, I'm going to throw it over to Leah, who's going to talk about this bipartisan consensus that's built up this massive and repressive system of immigration control over several decades, and the consensus that was built to maintain it. And then I'm going to come back at the end and talk about, again, what's different and new under Trumpism and what we need to learn from the last several decades to rebuild a movement for working people, regardless of where they were born or how they got here. So I'm going
to pass. Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for coming out. Okay, cool. So I was tasked with giving the history of the immigration system before Trump. So that's a lot. So I also know that there are a number of activists who've been active in the immigrants' rights movement. So feel free in the discussion to bring up anything that I miss or if, you know, there's things that you feel should be clarified more. ICE agents detained 3,168 undocumented immigrants over the course of 6 days in a national operation across all 50 states, three territories, Puerto Rico, and the District of Columbia. This sounds like a normal day under the Trump administration. However, this was in March 2012 under Obama. This sweep was called Dub Operation Cross Check, which was one of the largest single coordinated immigration sweeps in US history. Just as Lucy mentioned, Trump is a monstrous continuation of a deportation machine and immigration system that continues to exploit undocumented immigrants. This deportation machine and system has been created over decades throughout bipartisan support. I'm going to speak about how this machine came to be, along with adding snippets of my own family's experience within Texas, or rather Tejas. Trump's current rhetoric of referring to Mexicans as drug dealers, criminals, and rapists returns to anti-Mexican racism that has been present since the very beginning. This can be seen especially in the Southwest, which has a long history of the racist ideology as far back as the violence and colonization of Native Americans, Latinos, and Mexican population by Anglo settlers guided by Manifest Destiny. Mexican families living within the parts of the Southwest became American citizens overnight in the late 1800s at the end of the Mexican-American War and the signing of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. The saying, "We didn't cross the border crossed us," reflects this. During this time, my own family were farmers and lived in San Antonio. They would migrate following whatever immigration, whatever employment opportunities that became available. And they too became American citizens overnight. The Texas Rangers, which can be argued as form of vigilantes, were part of killing of 3,000 Mexican Americans, or Tejanos, between 1915 and 1919. What some historians have called some of the worst state-sanctioned racial violence in the U.S. The repression was both anti-immigrant and class repression. And this really great book, which I feel like is a really big primer, is in No One is Illegal by Justin Akers Chacon. He talks about this and how Native Americans, Irish, Chinese, Punjabis, Japanese, Filipinos, African Americans, and Mexicans, and trade unionists have been victims of this repression. Moving to 1917, which was a historic year, being the year the Russian working class overthrew the Tsar during the Russian Revolution, inspired such movements and struggles for revolution throughout Latin America, including Mexico. During this time, my great-grandfather was 5 years old when he came to Tejas from Zamora, Michigan, due to the violence of his youngest sister being kidnapped. 1 in 10 Mexicanos were killed. He was one of 1.5 million Mexicanos who crossed the border during this time. He took a train ride from Michigan to the border Nuevo Laredo, and once reaching the border, him and his family crossed the Rio Grande in a small boat to Tejas. Soon after, the Immigration Act of 1917 was passed and was one of the first restrictive immigration bills that made a turn to nativism, and it made a clear distinction as the type of immigrants that were wanted within the United States. It banned a long list, including anarchists, alcoholics, criminals, convicts, feeble-minded persons, insane persons, persons being mentally or physically defective, political radicals, and more. Immigration controls are a method used by the ruling class to control labor and to use at its wills to advance the capitalist project. The success of radicals of being able to organize effectively in the workplace, regardless of race or national origin in the early days of the labor movement, speaks to the reason why the radicals were also banned and seen as a threat to the ruling class. However, it did not exclude Mexican workers due to the need for their labor in agriculture and their temporary migration. And the creation of the Bursaro program between 1942 and 1964 allowed around 4.8 million Mexican workers to work temporarily in the agriculture season and then required them to return. This would involve making sure that they cross the border back into Mexico. This temporary status of workers can be seen in today's deferred action for childhood arrivals and temporary protective status, which leaves many immigrants in a limbo that only benefits the ruling class and capitalist parties, which I will touch upon soon. However, this is not to discount the rich history of organizing by Mexicans and others that have taken place. I definitely recommend Radicals in El Barrio, which Justin also released. It's in the Haymarket Book Group. My grandmother, Concepcion, who was born in Tejas and grew up only speaking Spanish, went to a Mexican-only school and would be hit by nuns if she did not speak English and was forced to assimilate, changing her name to Connie and only speaking English. Shortly after segregation ended, racism still persisted and still does in the Southwest. My grandfather, Antonio, went to apply for a job at the post office and was rejected multiple times. It was clear it was because he was Latino. Fast forwarding to the Immigration and Control Act of 1986, which passed during the Reagan administration, was one of the beginning steps in the expanding criminalization of undocumented workers. It provided amnesty for an estimated 2.7 million immigrants under very specific circumstances. Despite it being such one of the largest programs in U.S. history, it left around 2 million people still undocumented and who were unable to qualify. And a few ways that the bill expanded criminalization, it introduced employer sanctions, making it illegal to hire undocumented folks and with heavy fines if caught, reintroducing the limited guest worker plan in agriculture, and increased militarization of the border. Due to this increased criminalization of working while undocumented, there was a repression faced by workers regarding the lack of increases in wages and eventual downturn, which wasn't the case before. In addition, the beginnings of the border administration can be seen as far back as the 1970s under the Ford and Carter administration. During this time, there were Central American revolutionary movements that were happening that opposed U.S. imperialism, which was seen through the U.S.-backed dictators. The border was viewed as a doorway to three greatest threats to the United States: Central America's subversives, narco traffickers, and hordes of poor migrants. Under George W. H. Bush administration, temporary protective status was part of the Immigration Act of 1990. It gave power to the Attorney General to determine if citizens from certain countries would be authorized to work and stay in the United States until it was deemed safe. This being the case, it just depends on who's in the administration and how, again, immigrants are constantly being kept in this uncertain state. And Lucy will touch upon like the recent rulings on TPS. The militarization continued under the Clinton administration through the creation of Operation Gatekeeper, which used a strategy of control through deterrence that involved creating fences and blocking off popular crossing points. This made the journey of crossing even more treacherous and dangerous, often resulting in deaths. According to the humanitarian organization No More Deaths, they say the number of deaths due to dehydration and sunstroke in the summer or freezing the winter surged dramatically. Phase 2, although not formally part of Gatekeeper, was launched in October 1995, and it basically expedited hearings and deportations of undocumented workers apprehended at the U.S.-Mexico border. Noam Chomsky has said that the Operation Gatekeeper was a militarization of the U.S.-Mexican border, was intentionally passed and done to curb anticipated immigration increases with the implementation of the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA. With the limited trade and investment barriers with Canada, United States, and Mexico, it disseminated the Mexican local economy. There's an example like I've read where like in a small village, a local tortilla maker could not compete with the flood of American corn on the Mexican market. As socialists, we demand if capital can cross borders freely, so should people. The criminalization continued and increased after September 11th with the War on Terror, the framing of immigration as a national security issue under the Bush administration. The administration took advantage of the tragedy of 9/11 to spew its racist and xenophobic ideology against Muslims and folks of Arabic descent. This called for the increasing of securing our borders and a hyper-racialization of Arabs, Muslims, and even those who often face repression in general. During this time was the creation of Homeland Security and Immigration Customs and Enforcement, ICE, and the increasing of funding for Customs and Borders Protection. This was done with bipartisan support and a Democratic Congress, let's not forget that, that gave the far right the space and legitimacy to be pro-military in their interventions in the Middle East and openly racist, and much of these sentiments can be seen today with the creation and upholding of the Muslim ban. Operation Streamline, which began under Bush with zero tolerance of immigrants crossing the border. It led to cattle calls that would have a mass group of immigrants being tried at the same time and often shackled together. And again, it would consider border crossing a criminal matter as opposed to a civil one. And this is very familiar with the recent photos that have been leaked by The Intercept regarding the mass trials that are occurring now at the border. So I'll speak a little bit about, I grew up in Texas, so I'll speak a little bit about that in terms of like a local level, and just like how the repression was faced on the ground. In 2007, I was at a community college in Farmers Branch, a suburb of Dallas, Texas. During my time as a student, there was a local ordinance of Farmers Branch that was very similar to Arizona SB 1070, the Show Me Your Papers law, which makes it a crime for an immigrant in Arizona to be without carrying immigration documents and authorizes police to check the status of anyone they detain if they look suspicious. We all know what that means. At the time, two of my really good friends were undocumented, and every school day they would drive back and forth through the suburb to go to school, never realizing if they were going to get stopped. And again, what Lucy had touched upon about, you know, the new Jim Crow, and how, and like, I just want to touch upon that. And the ways in which immigrants have also been given second class status as workers. During this time, Farmers Branch also was trying to make it illegal to rent out an apartment or house to someone who was undocumented. This was all done on a local level. This legislation was repealed, and the town of Farmers Branch spent $5.8 million in legal fees to try to get this passed. When I was conducting research for this talk, specifically around Farmers Branch, I discovered that the man behind the local ordinance was also behind Arizona's SB 1070. His name is Chris Kobach, who is currently the Secretary of State of Kansas since 2011. He is also the former legal counsel for the Immigration Reform Law Unit, which is a legal arm of the Federation of American Immigration Reform, FAIR, which is a nativist organization that masks itself as an immigration think tank. And it, what it really does is play upon the rhetoric of criminalization of immigrants and racism to make a profit and put forth its own racist ideology. The Southern Poverty Law Center classifies FAIR as a hate group and a white nationalist organization that has actually put forth the idea that Mexico has a plan to reconquer the Southwest. Where am I on time? Okay, cool. So I'm going to touch briefly upon the mega marches of 2006, which I hope if people were there, like they can share that experience and what that was like, because they were very historic, and they occurred in the spring of 2006. They were a response to proposed legislation known as the Sensenbrenner Bill that would criminalize being undocumented in the U.S. as a criminal charge, and anyone aiding in assistance, and this could be charged, which simply by providing a ride, food, water, just any sort of thing. And what was really inspiring about these marches was that they were multiracial and multi-ethnic, and the people at the forefront were undocumented immigrants themselves. On May 1st, 2006, more than 1 million immigrants and allies took the streets on International Workers' Day for a day without an immigrant. There was a massive strike that left countless workplaces such as farms, factories, markets, restaurants shut down due to their dependence on immigrant labor. Back in Washington, the bill was revised, this time eliminating the criminalization aspects, but at the same time calling for an increase in border militarization enforcement. Neither the Senate or the House could receive enough support for any of these bills to pass. After the mega marches, there was a split within the immigrants' rights movements on tactics and the strategic questions. As Lupita Romero spoke in her talk, Deporter-in-Chief, The Sorry Truth About Comprehensive Immigration Reform, which is on We Are Many, check it out, wearemany.org. The split expressed itself between the more militant activists and the mainstream immigrants' rights groups. The leadership and unions called for a more electoral focus and called for a more humane immigration reform. And as socialists, we understand there's no such thing as a humane deportation machine. While the militant activists on the left of the movement called for amnesty for all, groups such as We Are American, composed of many mainstream immigrants' rights groups, would intervene in organizing and trying to shut it down after the marches to make an argument about make an argument against radical actions and urging people to register to vote, which. That's very problematic. We'll talk about that in the discussion. Needless to say, the vast majority of the energy by immigrants' rights groups were funneled into the Democratic Party and the presidential campaign for Obama. There's a saying that the Democratic Party is the graveyard of social movements, which rings true here. Mainstream groups see it the only strategy to win, often citing the lesser of two evils. There was so much writing on the election of Obama in 2008. His name was Barack Hussein Obama, and an African-American senator. And progressive and liberals who campaigned for him believed the change was going to happen. He ran on a platform of closing Guantanamo Bay, providing a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants, healthcare reform, and increasing the minimum wage. Mainstream immigrants' rights groups with electoral strategy took the position of supporting Obama. During his campaign, despite his three priorities for immigration reform being the following: one, border security; two, establishing a path to legalization that includes fines and adherence to the rule of law; and three, a guest worker program. Once elected, the opportunity to pass comprehensive immigration reform with a Democrat in office and the majority of a Democratic Congress was wasted. Instead, Obama continued to put off his campaign promises. Mainstream immigrants' rights groups did not want to pressure him. In a policy position circulated by the Center for American Progress in 2007, it argued for this shifting toward rhetoric and emphasizing undocumented immigrants needing to make up for breaking the law and paying fines, jumping through hoops, and just a list of things. Alfonso Gonzalez and Reform Without Justice. Lucy's gonna, yeah. Great. Okay, let's wear my. Talks about this and about how the groups moved the conversation to the right and played the good and bad immigrant that was so commonly used, like the rhetoric used by the right and now even the Democrats. The leading Democratic Party affiliated groups consciously shift the strategy, and it shifted to the right, being about enforcement and making undocumented people pay a price to stay here. During his presidential terms, Obama expanded enforcement and capacity of Homeland Security and became known as the deporter-in-chief to immigrants' rights activist and socialist. During his eighth year, he deported 2.5 million people, more than every single U.S. president of the 20th century combined. His immigration enforcement budget was $18 billion and larger than all other enforcement agencies combined again. And then during Obama, some of the changes that happened is he moved away from workplace raids, but instead saying like ICE would only focus on high priorities. But yet two-thirds of the people who were deported had committed minor infractions, including like traffic violations, and didn't have a criminal report at all. Through the expansion of Homeland Security, it began to replace a program called 287G programs, which were passed by the Clinton administration, which allowed ICE to partner with local law enforcement agencies and basically gives the local police the powers of federal immigration agents. And they shift that to secure communities, which basically did the same thing. Like, they're just trying to change, like, make it sound, ooh, secure communities, right? Let's see. Secure communities is highly racialized because it gives the local law enforcement the capacity to pick up someone for simply being brown. And this was seen throughout the large number of deportations. For example, the vast mass majority of deportations are Latinx, and although only 7% of non-citizens in the U.S. are black, they make up 20% of those facing deportations on a criminal grounds. And that really talks about how like the mass incarceration system, like they feed into each other in terms of like the immigration system. And also the use of, under Obama, E-Verify, which is an online worker identification systems of the federal government. In 2007, Bush made the program mandatory for all federal contractors. However, it increased dramatically under Obama. DACA. There's so much to say about DACA, so I'm sorry. There's people here who could probably speak to it. But anyways, it was only through direct action, organizing, and militancy of Dreamers, young people who came to the United States as children and had been organizing for Dream Act since 2001, did Obama respond to the pressure. He had promised more and ran on a platform of hope. From the work done by Dreamers, including sit-ins and offices and the taking over the streets, Dreamers came to the temporary protected status called the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA, in 2012. Immigrants that were eligible were childhood arrivals who were brought to the United States here before the age of 16. The DACA program temporarily exempts recipients from detention and deportation. It must be renewed every 3 years, and they're required to work, pay taxes, and either be in school or join the military and not be charged with a crime. And as socialists, you know, again, we stand with all immigrants, regardless of national origin, race, gender identity, or whether or not they have a criminal record. Obama used the rhetoric again in terms of through the passage of DACA about like a good and bad immigrant, like who's deserving and who to be here. And this can be seen through his administration's expanded visas for high-tech workers, something big businesses have been wanting for a really long time. Okay, and as viewing as an opening with the passage of DACA, once again, mainstream immigrants' rights groups decided to support Obama during his second term beginning in 2013. However, situations of undocumented immigrants only became worse. Under Obama, the detention bed mandate in 2010 set a quota guaranteeing the minimum number of 34,000 detainees. The average daily population of detained immigrants increased from 5,000 in 1994 to 19,000 in 2001 and over 39,000 in 2007. Immigrants have become the fastest growing parts of the prison population, and the government is using the collaboration between ICE and the criminal justice system. As Lucy has mentioned, there abuses have been commonly faced in these detention centers under the Obama administration, not only including like women and children, but also trans women. I think that's really important. There's a lot of research that's been done about it. In 2014, more than 57,000 migrant children from Central America arrived in the United States. They were fleeing the violence and economic devastation in their countries. Much of this was caused by the United States imperialism and the ruling class of these countries. What was Obama's response? To make sure that these young children were, to make sure that these young children were given a speedy deportation. Obama asked Congress to approve a $3.7 billion in emergency funding. The administration claimed it was to help children in detention. However, what it really did was designed to speed up the deportation of children and adults alike from extra funds from Border Patrol, from the appointment for more immigration judges to speed up proceedings against detainees. This was from a Socialist Worker article entitled A Flood of Bigotry at the Border by Mario Candadas. Hillary Clinton, former Secretary of State, while on a book tour, said that these children should be sent back to the violence they were escaping. In an interview, she was asked, should the children be sent back? It's much safer here. Hillary, it may be safer, but that's not the answer. And then she continues to discuss border security, and they should be sent back and send a message that just because your child can get across the border, then that, you know, they can't stay. This is despite the fact that the children, many of the children have been eligible for refugee status. And again, I spoke a lot to just like what's you know been seen like this, like the continuing of the immigration deportation machine. Now Lucy will discuss ways in which it's been different under Trump and what does that mean for us as socialists and activists. Thank you.
Give it up for Leah Ramirez, given her first socialism talk. And then, all right. Okay, so I'm sort of tasked with talking about what's different under Trump, and I'm going to talk less about actual policy and talk more about politics. And so we kind of painted this picture of, so there's a long history of like racist, you know, discrimination against immigrants. In the post-civil rights era, they have to find a new way to cloak it, right? And they cloak it in the language of criminality. Post-September 11th, they cloak it in the language of fighting terror. and so that's sort of the program, and it creates it, and it's working. You know, it's working for American business, right? Like, you've got the percentage of foreign-born workers in this country has been going up since like the 90s, pretty astronomically, and we're back to the levels of like the early 20th century after going down. In places like New York City, it's like 50% of the workforce is foreign-born, and so it's a huge, you know, in certain sectors, a really big section of the workforce that is in this second-class kind of citizen status of various different levels of immigration, and this is a system that's, I think, working well for the bosses, right? And so then Trump comes along, right? And he's smashing the whole thing up in many ways, right? I mean, there's food rotting on the vine in, you know, certain agricultural sectors. There's places where they can't get enough workers, etc. And so what's this Trumpism about? And I do want to say that Trump is a break from the system that came before. And it's not an isolated thing. Like, this is happening around the world, right? You have a rise of far-right nationalist politics, especially in Europe. And it's not surprising. This is a world in which, you know, what is it, 1 in 7 people are migrants, right? Because of war, because of imperialism, because of economic instability and environmental crisis, people are being forced to flee. And then where are they fleeing to? They're fleeing to a lot of, you know, the richer countries. But what's happening in those richer countries? Social safety nets are being cut, right? And people are feeling squeezed, and people are feeling, you know, there's a social crisis going on in certainly in this country, right? And so then in that situation, there's an audience to say to say to people, oh, well, look, the problem is these immigrants who are a drain on our social services and are stealing our jobs and all that kind of thing. And this is an international phenomenon that's happening. There's a particular American narrative to this, or history to these politics. Trump didn't just make up this shit. You know what I mean? Like, this is a playbook that has been written over the last several decades. And, you know, Leah mentioned some of the antagonists in this, like Chris Kobach and Fair. There are these right-wing think tanks that they've been promulgating this shit for a long time, right? And they are funded by certain sections of capital, right? There's the Scaife family, who are the heirs to the Mellon fortune. They seem to have immigration as their thing. And so they fund Fair, they fund all these organizations. They also fund things like the Cato Institute and the Heritage Foundation, which, you know, not only are anti-immigrant, but they're pro-military, right? And they're pro, you know, security state, and they're anti-affirmative action. And, you know what I mean? It's a whole package, basically. These groups have been organizing for a long time and have been funded by certain sections of the capitalist class. But it's not just kooky, like, billionaires like the Scaife Foundation or the Scaife family. There's also, if you look at the people who funded the House Immigration Reform Caucus, which is the far right House caucus that comes up with all the worst legislation, you know, some of their top donors are from like the National Home Builders Association and the National Restaurant Association. And so there's big sections of capital were like, yeah, we'll fund this. Of course we want immigrants here, right? We want them to be low-wage workers, but we want immigrants here, but we're gonna fund these really far-right groups that wanna get rid of all immigrants because it helps move the entire immigration debate to the right and give immigrants fewer and fewer rights. And that's what's been going on. And Trump just took all that and took it to its logical conclusion and said, you know what I mean? Like, we're gonna go hog around this. And as Justin Akers Chacon says in No One Is Illegal, you know, anti-immigrant politics has been sort of a get-rich-quick scheme for politicians with flagging careers. And that's what happened to Trump. Like, he wasn't really going anywhere until he started hitting that anti-immigrant, you know, thing. And the and Jeff Sessions in 2015, Jeff Sessions wants to get rid of all immigrants in this country. Like, he wants to return the U.S. to a white and subservient black population, whatever. And he wrote a memo in 2015 to the Republican Party saying, this is the ticket. Like, you know, a Republican running on a program of immigrants, you know, stealing jobs and draining social resources from social services, that's what's going to win the next election. And he turned out to be right about this. Now, nothing of this is inevitable, right? Like, the Democrats and the failure of the Democrats to pose any kind of alternative is obviously a major part of this story, right? And I think you can see that in you can have this anti-immigrant message that, you know, gets people to blame all their economic woes on immigrants, or you can have a message of universal health care and college education for everybody, and, you know, that combines that with, like, you know, an anti-racist platform, and you can get a hearing. And, you know, Bernie Sanders got that hearing, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez got that hearing, but the mainstream of the Democratic Party is not willing to do that for many of the reasons that Heather talked about, of just they're completely wedded to, in particular September 11th, the Democratic Party is completely wedded to, you know, border security, the war on terror, the security state, and all these kind of things. And therefore, there's not much of a space to the, you know, they're not willing to really do what it would take to fight against this whole thing. Okay, and I went off script, so I gotta figure out where I am here. Okay. Yeah, I went through all that. September 11th. Oh God, I went through a lot of this. Okay. Give me one second. Luckily I numbered my pages. Oh, here we go. Wow, I went through that a lot more quickly than I expected to. Okay, so in this context, the fight around immigration is just completely central to American politics right now, because it's a major part of the right-wing base that has been built up. And it's a major part of our side, right? It's a major part of how we're gonna fight around, you know, liberation for working class people in this country. And I think we have to be honest that up till recently, under the Trump administration, the immigrant rights movement has been, has been really thrown into a tailspin. You know what I mean? I mean, people feel under siege, but I think that the mainstream immigrant rights groups have been quite paralyzed under the Trump administration and somewhat unable to know how to fight back. And I think that there's a couple of different reasons for this. I think that, as Heather said, I think a lot of it has to do with being politically disarmed and having a whole strategy that was tied up with supporting comprehensive immigration reform, which again was all about border security on the one side, and then, you know, this very narrow set of rights on the other side. And as Heather talked about, the way that the momentum from the mega marches was funneled into comprehensive immigration reform. But it's also important to talk about the role of the union movement in this, because in the year 2000, like, if you go back to the year 2000, the AFL-CIO came out in favor of amnesty for undocumented immigrants because they understood that immigrants were a critical part of the labor movement in this country. And then if immigrant workers were not able to organize and fight for their rights, and join unions and fight for their rights, the entire labor movement would be hamstrung, right? And I just went to a great talk that Justin gave about his book, Radicals in the Barrio, that goes through the incredibly central role he talks specifically about Mexican immigrants, but, you know, you can go back, all sorts of immigrants have played in the labor movement in this country in defending the rights of, you know, of workers, et cetera. In 2003, the AFL-CIO organized an immigrant worker freedom ride with thousands of immigrants riding buses across the country, ending in a massive rally in Flushing Meadows Park. So that's in 2003, and they're calling for amnesty, right? And by 2007, that just in the course of like 3-4 years, that strategy has gone into unions support, like SEIU, becoming a leading force in actually lowering people's expectations, saying that we can't talk about amnesty, we can only talk about this very narrow path towards legalization. But we have to understand that the problems of lowered expectations, the problems are not, right, and so I think it's a political question of, you know, actually the strategies that it's going to take to that have disarmed a lot of these groups in trying to figure out how to move forward. Obviously, repression is a huge part of this as well, right? And I think that a lot of people are just living in fear right now of what is a reign of terror, you know, by the Trump administration. I mean, we organized in Jackson Heights in Queens, and you know, right after the big women's marches from a year ago, you know, we had meetings where undocumented folks were coming out and talking about like, how do we fight this? And I think that since then, a lot of people have just, you know, been very shell-shocked and just feeling like, you know, not confident to come out and organize. But we also have to understand the way that the massive immigration control system that has been built up for decades exerts massive pressure and control over everyday people's lives. Much as poor and working people's lives are regulated by the police and prison systems and the welfare systems and the child protective systems, the tens of millions of immigrants living in this country have their lives directly regulated by the immigration system, which they are constantly trying to navigate and live under the thumb of. Even a sizable chunk of the undocumented population are actually known to and under the direct surveillance of ICE. This includes the 300,000 people with temporary protective status, around 700,000 currently with DACA status, and the 2.3 million people living under orders of supervision. If you add undocumented family members, you know, you're talking about a huge section of the 11 million undocumented folks who are actually living under this level of supervision, along with the tens of millions of other immigrants in the immigration system. But these are considered the lucky ones because they've been allowed to stay and have been granted work permits. These conditions leave much of the immigrant population beholden to the supposed good graces of ICE officials, employers, and or Democratic Party politicians, who we are told we need to elect every couple of years to keep all these temporary statuses and other supposed protections in place. And this has created concrete challenges to organizing and articulating common demands as people grapple with their individual cases, constantly being compelled to prove why they are good Americans and deserving to be here. It has also fostered the development of a vast network of NGOs and legal organizations focused on providing resources to mitigate immediate legal challenges and expansions of relief policies rather than challenging the immigration system as a whole. Can I grab some water? Thank you. And I think a lot of these big groups have actually, you know, there's an amazing amount of litigation and legal work actually going on right now around immigration, you know, and around Trump's attacks. There's lawsuits that are filed, you know, against the repeal of DACA, against the repeal of the various temporary protected statuses. You know, actually, it was a federal lawsuit that has forced the Trump administration to continue to process DACA, you know, DACA applications. It was a federal judge that ordered the Trump administration to reunite the families with the children who were separated. But in the long term, I think that these there's a huge amount of energy, again, being put by a lot of these NGOs, et cetera, into a legal strategy that in the end, I think we know we can't rely on the courts to protect our rights. And in fact, we saw this with the Muslim ban that was, initially was reversed by the courts, but in the end was upheld. But I think that people are seeing more and more that actually we can't rely on the courts and we need to build mass movements in the streets to shift the whole paradigm. Of course, despite all the repression and the social controls, immigrants continue to resist, right? Groups like Mi Gente and the National Sanctuary Coalition are immigrant-led organizations actively organizing against detention and deportations and having successes and impacts on a local level. In New York, we work closely with a South Asian group called Desi's Rising Up and Moving to prevent the deportation of a Bangladeshi father, Riaz Talukdar, who had been in this country and working legally for 35 years. And like all working people, the place where immigrants are least atomized and have the most collective power is through their labor. And there continues to be important and inspiring work going on when it comes to immigrant worker organizing, whether it be through migrant justice in Vermont, which has won important victories among dairy workers there, Voces de la Frontera in Wisconsin, the ongoing work of the Amalkaki workers in Florida. However, all of these groups have been under attack themselves and spend an enormous time and energy just fighting against the targeting and deportation of their own leaders. And when I was in Justin's talk, Mexican labor radicals of about a century ago, he quoted a Guatemalan communist organizer who was going in the South fighting against, launched a whole campaign in the South fighting against, Jim Crow and deportations, and said, people can't organize when they're living under terror. You know what I mean? And so the terror actually has we have to actually fight the terror, you know what I mean? To give people the space to organize and fight for their rights. So just to wrap up, I think it's important to say that Trump's attacks have removed the supposedly race-neutral and pro-good immigrant facade of the immigration system. And things like the Muslim ban, ending temporary protected status, ending DACA, refusing asylum to victims of domestic violence and gang violence, openly and unapologetically warehousing and traumatizing children for political gain, now wanting to end family reunification, sharply reduce the avenues to legal migration, and he's launched a task force, a denaturalization task force, right? So he's basically declared war on the entire immigrant population. And while that's obviously terrorizing and traumatizing, it's also radicalizing, right? Because it's forcing folks to re-examine the years of compromise that have gotten us to where we are now, and seeing that we can't accept a framework that trades, small gains for small sections of people for a system that just further denies the overall rights of the rest of the population. And with like so many issues we are facing in this period, the potential of reorganizing resistance forces on a more radical basis exists, right? And I think that's what the Abolish ICE slogan represents, right? And many of the struggles, I think many of the struggles we've been involved in, we will continue to be involved in, whether it's fighting particular deportations or workplace organizing, et cetera. But there's an opportunity to organize struggles that take on the very existence of ICE itself, right? And so the workers who are, demanding that their companies not that not cooperate with DHS, right? The occupations of the detention centers. This is a movement that takes on, you know, not just this or that policy, but the entire structure of the immigration and the right of our government to deny basic rights to people just because they were born in another country. Okay, I'll wrap up. And Cosecha, I don't know if folks are familiar, they're they're a predominantly undocumented youth-led organization. They're calling for a national day of action on June 31st that's all about this. It's about, resisting, July 31st. And I don't know if that's gonna take off or not, but that's the right initiative, right? And they're calling on, if your school cooperates with DHS, if your company cooperates with DHS, does your county, make money off of detention centers? Can you, and so that's the kind of direction that I think this movement needs to go in. And I'll just end by saying that I think, the rise and the opening that we've seen for socialist ideas also means an opportunity to build a movement for immigrant rights that posits the immigrant population where it belongs, a constituent part of the working class in this country, right? And that we need to fight for that it's part of our struggle to unify our working class movement against the bosses, against the politicians that would deny us our rights, against the corporations that are driving down living standards in this country. And so I think, it's been hard. You know what I mean? It's been a really hard year and a half for anybody who has been paying any attention to this issue, right? And certainly, most so for the people who've lived it most acutely. But I think there is a real opening to rebuild a movement on a completely different basis that demands the basic humanity of everyone in this country, regardless of where they were born and how they got here.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.